Mr. Brown, Reel 7. Right, Mr. Brown, we're still in this early period before the battalion was withdrawn to the Middle East. Could you just talk us through a typical day when you were in frontline positions from, you know, from dawn through till dusk, what you would be doing?
Well, when I came back from B Company, the battalion headquarters was in a sort of hollow in the mountains, and that's where I stayed for the rest of the time that the battalion was over the Grigliano. And lines had been set out to the companies, and a little exchange put in what was called a sanger. It was some boulders built up against the side of this hollow and a tarpaulin stretched over the top just to give you some protection from rain and so on and protect the exchange. And if you were on duty, you were in there and ready to put calls through from one company to another or from companies to headquarters. And there was no training or anything going on in that respect. That was just your life. You just sort of lived out in the open there and waited for to be either sent forward again or taken back.
Now, so would you have like a specific period of duty when you would be on?
Oh yes, it would be broken up into periods. I couldn't tell you how long they might be. But of course, it had to be all night as well. You had to do the overnight as well as through the day.
And you were sleeping effectively undercover, but in the open?
Not undercover, no. There's only this little attachment for the exchange that was undercover. The rest you were out in the open.
So you would be allocated a specific period of duty.
Mm-hmm.
What about things like meal times and rations and so on? I mean, let's take us through a typical day. You wake up, and then through the day from there, would there be a breakfast or would it?
Yes, we had these little tin arrangements where you could heat water on, and I remember OXO cubes. You could, you know, on the compo rations, you got OXO cubes and you could make yourself a cup of OXO and eat whatever those there. I don't remember much about eating. All I remember about eating is the when it became dusk, the mules came up and the compo rations came up, and you seemed to just eat when you wanted to eat. You know, there's no sort of bugle call and you all went to the certain point and ate. You just sort of stuck where you were, and whatever tins you had or whatever you had to eat, you ate when you felt like it, it seems to me.
So all the rations had to be brought up overnight?
That's right. Once the dusk fell, the rations could come up, because even so, you got shells coming over, and, you know, while we were there, you know, there's quite a few shells flying about around this hollow. So, you know, you had to keep your head down, more or less.
Were you troubled by snipers at this stage?
No, the snipers wouldn't have been able to see us, I don't think. It'd be further away.
In terms of, I mean, you were living in pretty rough conditions.
Yes, it was cold as well, because this was the end of January.
Now, did they issue any extra clothing or...?
Well, we had blankets and we had great coats and gas capes and ground sheets and that sort of thing, yes.
And were they effective?
Well, I seem to can't remember not sleeping well, to be honest.
Other veterans have talked about the kind of the sleeveless leather jerkin being like a prized item of kit.
It would be, but I'm afraid I never had one.
Did anybody else that you knew?
Not in at that stage. I didn't see anybody wearing them. Not around battalion headquarters, as you can call it.
Now, during this period, when you were manning this kind of this exchange, this link facility between the different companies, who would be directly responsible? Who would you be directly responsible to in terms of who would be giving you the orders and who would be kind of enforcing?
Well, the sergeants were there, and the sergeant, the corporal, and the signal officer.
And again, we mentioned previously the business of lines being cut occasionally, mm-hmm. and this will have been happening during this period. That would you ever be assigned on details to fix this?
I never went out on mending lines in that period. I did later on, but I don't ever remember going out to mend a line when we were in that position.
Mm-hmm. Now, given these rough conditions, how often would you be kind of medically inspected, you know, in terms of, you know, apparently kind of trench foot and things like that, would those kind of ailments were kind of coming back in?
Well, at that time, at the Grigliano, we just weren't.
So there wasn't that kind of problems of people coming down with, you know...
No, I don't think there was that trench foot problem because it wasn't damp mud. It was rocky, and any rain that you got sort of ran down the hillside out of the rocks.
Now, you mentioned the shell fire. Were you able to sleep overnight? Did the Germans put up like nuisance?
Well, they used to have what was called stonks, and I mean, they knew that the rations were coming up at a certain time, and it seemed to be, you know, pretty regular that some shells would come over at a certain time. But
what time would they be?
Well, I think it's about dusk and shortly afterwards. But there was an odd one during the day as well. But I don't remember shelling stopping us from sleeping at that time.
And what about the British shells? Would you be affected by?
No, I don't remember that at all.
So you would just get used to this as a background noise?
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier about when you were with B Company, at one point you managed to get the radio connected up to the American Forces Network, and you were listening to a broadcast. Now, other veterans have talked about the signal as being kind of in the know in terms of a little bit more than, you know, the other members of the battalion, in terms of you would get the news first. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about that at this stage, where you would actually have an idea of what was actually going on? Because obviously you were in touch with all the different companies and so on.
No, I don't remember so much then getting any news from anywhere, but I think we were among the first to hear when ANZIO started, for instance, and things like that, that we'd be the first to pick it up.
And how would you pick it up?
Well, I think it'd come from the signals officer. They must have had some kind of intimation of what was happening. And, you know, it was a close-knit platoon, and we'd hear about it.
Now, you're in direct communication, obviously, with the signalers, with the rifle companies.
Yes.
Now, first of all, was it possible just to have, like, a conversation with a friend in another company? And secondly, was that frowned upon by the authorities? Were we able to just like have a chat, and did the higher ups say, you know, just business conduct, you know?
Oh, it was frowned upon, really. You weren't supposed to do things like that.
But did you?
Probably.
So it was possible to have like a conversation about what a particular person was doing in a particular company somewhere else, and.
Well, I don't think we ever sort of went into what are you doing now, and et cetera, et cetera. Just passing the time of day, more or less.
Now, obviously, at this stage, you had these landlines put down. But when you were using the radio, did the Germans ever try to jam the radios?
Yes. Yes, they did.
How did they do that?
Well, it was just a sort of jumble of noise. It was just a ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. All the time, so that you couldn't make out any words that were being spoken over the radio. And I remember once, you've got a code word to change the frequency, and I changed the frequency and got the companies back on. This is when I was CO signaller, and within about 5 minutes, that it had started again. I mean, they just, if you went off one frequency, they'd just go around on their radio bands and find you again and start this racket.
You mentioned you had a code word for different frequencies. About how many frequencies could you choose?
I just remember having code word to change from one frequency if it got difficult to another one.
Can you remember what that code word was?
Oh, no. It might have changed every day or every week or every month.
Now, on the same tack, did the battalion signallers ever try to listen to the German radios?
I never did. I never heard of anybody doing that, no.
And
I don't know if there are any German speakers amongst us in any case.
And in terms of if their radios were jammed, that wouldn't have anything to do with battalion signallers. There'd be nobody within the signal platoon jamming their broadcast, is what I'm saying.
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
I think it was going to be jamming. It would be done from higher up, mm-hmm. Brigade or division or something like that.
Was the German, was that a common thing for the Germans to do, or was it unusual?
I thought we would say unusual, but it didn't happen all the time.
Now, again, just a question on the radios and the equipment generally. Was it the responsibility of the signalers to maintain the, to do maintenance on the equipment, or would it be sent back, apart from, like, basic maintenance? What would be...
No, we had a chap called Jack Howe, Lance Corporal Howe, who used to look after the maintenance of all the radios and that type of thing.
And so that would be done within the unit?
If possible, yes, he used to do most of it.
Now, we were talking before about, you were talking about your experiences with B Company, and it was three men per company sent forward. Would that be three men just with one radio?
Yes.
So it would be, at this stage, there would only be one radio per company?
Yes.
So the three men, why would there be three? Would that be taking turns to carry it?
It would be taking turns to carry it, yes, and taking turns to use it, because you couldn't be on duty with it all the time. And like being on guard duty, you need six men or something to get through the night.
Now... was that the same throughout from 39 to 45? It was always just one radio per company.
I don't know about 1939 to 45.
Oh, 43 to 45.
Yes, yes.
Now, you're in these frontline positions. I suppose from what you were saying earlier, you were able to keep up with the news via broadcast and so on, so we had a general awareness of what was going on on the rest of the battlefront and back in England. Yeah. What about the mail situation, letters to and from home? How often were you able to write?
Well, I suppose you could write as often as you wanted. It was getting them sent away. Obviously, there wasn't much being sent away when you were in the front line, and there wasn't much being received when you were in the front line. It's when you came out that... you got so anywhere reasonably settled that the mail came up and you got your mail away.
So there could be weeks, gaps of weeks?
Possibly. It seemed, I wouldn't say weeks, but it didn't seem that long, but it was possible, yes. I don't know how long we were over the Grigliano, but I can't remember any mail or anything coming around then.
What about the issue of censorship? Apparently all the mail, the outgoing mail, had to be censored. Mm. So were you conscious of that when you wrote home about what you could say?
Oh, yes, you were conscious of it. You kept things out of the letters that, were sensitive.
And so I suppose the letter would just be basically just a reassurance that you were okay.
You're still there.
Could you actually say where you were specifically?
No.
So as far as... Found you back in England, concerned. You were just in Italy.
Yes.
And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they would know what unit you were with.
Yes.
That would be part of the address, so they would know the unit.
That's right.
You're in Italy, but that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, in terms of you know, being within the signal platoon, did you feel generally with other signals, did you all feel that you were kind of possibly different from the other soldiers from the rifle platoon? Did you feel like a community of?
I think there was that sort of feeling. I must admit that you know, you were something different. Yes.
Because I think other veterans have talked about the signal, people regarding the signal as being a little bit brighter and a little bit smarter, and thinking of themselves as a little bit brighter and smarter.
We'd like to think so, but I'm not sure how true it was.
Any other aspects of this first period in the front line, this period after the Griglia, into February?
No, I think we covered it pretty well.
So, what happened then?
Well, we were brought out from the Grigliano. I remember walking out and passing people who were just going up the other way and feeling sorry for them. And then it's more or less a blur till we're getting on the boat at Naples, I think it was, and suddenly we were off to the Middle East.
Now, we'll talk about that in a minute, but what was the general condition of the battalion? Because apparently, according to the battalion history, you were in the line for 6 weeks before you moved out.
Well, I think we were, you know, pretty well shattered at that time. And most of the people I spoke to about it felt, you know, direly in need of a rest and a break.
And in terms of health, general health, were people affected?
I don't know about health. I can't remember the health being affected, but certainly people were tired.
So you got on the boat. Did you know where you were going to?
I think we did. Yeah, I think we knew we were due to go to the Middle East. Anyway, we landed at Port Said, I remember.
What was your impression of that?
Oh, I can't remember Port Said at all, no. I just, the next thing I remember is being at Casassin, it was called, and being just on the desert floor in a two-man bivvy with Danny Jordan. That's about the next thing I remember.
And what was this camp? What place was this? Where was this near? It was still in Egypt.
Oh yes, yeah.
And what were your duties there? What happened at this camp?
We had training, but we didn't do a great deal because we were all given some leave in Cairo. And it was really a staging post for going to other places in the Middle East. And I remember we had so many days in Cairo.
What do you think of Cairo?
Well, I thought at last, you know, I'm somewhere really foreign. It really seemed different. And of course, we went to see the mosque, and we went to see the pyramids and the Sphinx, and it really seemed much more foreign than anything I'd met up to that time.
And how did people get on with the locals, the local people? How did they regard?
Well, when we were in Casassin, we didn't see the locals.
And what about Cairo?
I don't know how much they sort of got involved with locals. You're only there for 4 or 5 days, whatever it was. So I can't remember coming into contact much with the locals at all.
They tried to
polish your shoes and things like that. And going down into the souk to have a look around and buying a bit of jewellery to send home, things like that.
And in terms of things to do in Cairo, was there plenty of like bars and cinemas and things? Was there plenty of places?
It was mostly bars, I think. Don't remember going to cinema there. We went out at night and found a nice bar, and that was it.
And I presume it would be full of soldiers.
Well, there was quite a lot there, yeah.
And so you're in this camp, you basically, what kind of training were you doing?
Just more or less drill and weapons training. But I can't remember much training done at all, really, at that time. As I say, we were en route somewhere else.
Now, you mentioned when you first joined the battalion that the discipline was quite relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And did it change when you were back into this barracks camp kind of environment? Did it become stricter? Or? Right, Mr. Brown, we're talking about discipline in the rear areas. So it was still quite relaxed within the battalion.
Yes, I felt it was relaxed. Didn't seem onerous at all.
Now, you were back in a kind of camp environment. Did people like the regimental sergeant major and the company sergeant major, did they become more visible to you at this stage, making their presences felt? You haven't really mentioned them.
No, I haven't mentioned them. No, I don't think they did make their presence felt. The RSM, I always got on very well with because he was captain of the football team, and the RSM never caused me any problems. And I remember the CSM, it must have been when we were back at Casasin. It wasn't when we were there, because I'd got something in my leg. I know what it was. We had these shorts, etc., and the stockings pulled up, and people stuck pencils down in the signal platoon so that they had pencils when they had to take messages and whatnot. And somebody, I don't know who it was, jumped out of the back of a lorry when I was standing there, and this pencil caught in the back of my leg and broke off, and consequently I had a nice piece of lead stuck in the back of my leg. And I went to the RAP, of course, and they took it out, but it sort of festered on and on and on in the sand and whatnot. And I remember by the time we got back to Casasin, I was on the sick list. I'm trying to remember what they call it. They call it something. But anyway, and so the company had gone out early in the morning, presumably for physical training and exercises. And I, of course, stayed in bed. And I remember the sergeant major coming around then, and, you know, lifting up, you know, what you're doing in bed. And I just said, it's a 3D or something like that. And he said, oh, all right, you know, go back to sleep. So, you know, they were making sure that nobody was malingering at that time. But nothing too onerous.
Can you remember who the sergeant, company sergeant major was at this time?
Oh, I should know him. Oh, I can picture him. No, have you got any names?
What about the regimental sergeant major?
Thomason, I suppose.
Now,
Gates. I'm sure it was Gates, the company sergeant major Gates.
Hmm. What kind of man was he then? He was?
Well, very pleasant, really, I think.
So not the stereotype sergeant major?
No, well, I suppose he was if he had to be on the parade ground. But I think in normal life he wouldn't have been like that.
Now, had they started to organise kind of football games? I mean, because you played football for the battalion,
yeah,
later. Mm. Had they started by this stage? Were you able to?
I think the first time we had a football game after I joined the battalion was when we got into Palestine and we were near Netanya. And I remember we played a company game. And so the companies must have been playing each other. And then, after playing in the company game, I was asked to play for the battalion.
And who were the other good footballers within the company and within the battalion? Could you just like describe some of the other personalities.
I remember Jerry Best. I think he was in the support company. He was a wonderful inside forward. He really was good. And he played for the division. And in the end, he went to British troops in Austria, which we might mention later. Armstrong in goal was very good, very competent, much older, he seemed, than I was. But he was very good. And Thomason himself was a good centre-half, the regimental sergeant major. Big Jock Moody was a very, very strong half-back. And it was Swainston was the right-back to my left-back, and he was very competent. We had a pretty good side, I felt. Maybe not as good as some of the other battalions, but we had a reasonable side.
And who would organise?
I think Thomason would organise most of the games.
Now, were any of the officers good players? Did any of them?
There weren't any officers on the team. Whether there were any good players or not, and they preferred not to to play, I don't know.
Well, what about at the company level? Would there be?
No, there weren't any officers playing in headquarters company team either.
What about other sports that I mean, apparently there's a cricket was...
Cricket, I played cricket for the company. We had a cricket team in the end, but I can't remember playing any cricket in the Middle East.
Not at this stage.
No.
Yeah. So this was at the start of your involvement with the battalion in football.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And would you, at this stage, would you be playing other... You know, other units, other battalions.
Other units in wherever they were, yes.
And would there be spectators? Would it be kind of a bit of a social event as well?
Oh, yes. It was quite keenly supported, really, because it was something to do.
Now, so you had your 4 days leave in Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
And you're involved in... effectively light training. Now, according to the battalion history, you moved near to Tel Aviv after this.
Yes, I remember moving to Netanya, which I suppose must have been near Tel Aviv. And it was near Tel Aviv. I remember walking along more or less the coast road, into Tel Aviv, or near Tel Aviv, yes.
And apparently there was quite a bit of civil unrest at this stage.
There was... But it was nothing serious as regards casualties, sort of guard duties and patrols to try and keep down the trouble.
Did anybody try to explain to you what the situation was in Palestine?
No.
So, and what was people's general understanding of why these people were at odds with each other?
No, I don't think people did really understand.
And was there any sense of a sense of who was right and who was wrong?
No. I can't remember getting too much involved, to be honest.
So you weren't involved in any of the... apparently there was street patrols put out and so on.
We didn't have to do any. The signal platoon didn't do any.
And you didn't actually, deploy as a platoon in terms of laying landlines and all the rest of it? That wasn't done at this time?
No.
Now... around about this time, apparently, the signal platoon and the headquarters company had photographs taken, as did a lot of the companies. Can you remember where that was at?
No.
But it was during this Middle East period.
Yes, but I can't remember where.